Gig session number 33130, Reel 1.
Captain Keat, tape 1, side 1. So where and when were you born?
Well, I was born in 1913, believe it or not. And I was born in Blackheath, and I went to school in Blackheath. But I didn't want to go into my father's foundry, so I decided I would like to go to sea and become a ship's officer, where I was told I would wear white uniform with gold braid and a telescope and the lovely sun and moon in the Mediterranean. But of course it hasn't actually worked out like that. However, when I was 16, I was appointed to go as a cadet in Baring Oil Tanker Company. But the Depression came, 1929, and so that faded out. But I was able to go to the Shipping Federation, and they appointed me as an apprentice to Glover Brothers of London. And I served 4 years as an apprentice on a ship called Shakespeare. And then when I had got my second mate certificate, I became third officer of one of their ships, the Romney. By 1936, I had put sufficient time in to get my mate certificate, first mate certificate. But as soon as I had got it, the Depression had really hit, and all British ships were laid up, or most of them. But fortunately, the Spanish Civil War had started, and our Navy was suddenly quite committed, and they converted a British tanker into a Royal Fleet auxiliary ship owned by the Admiralty, and I joined her as second officer. And that was the beginning of being in the Admiralty service rather than in a private company. And in 1937, an Admiralty Fleet order came out suggesting that RAF officers should join the Royal Naval Reserve. And so by 1938, I had been appointed after a medical and interview at the Admiralty as probationary sub-lieutenant R&R. I continued serving in Arndale as second officer, and we were actually in New Zealand and Australia oiling their naval ships when the war cloud, Hitler started the war, or the war began.
So what were your duties as a second officer?
Well, she was an Admiralty tanker. My duties were, of course, to keep watch at sea from 12 to 4 and import to, and we had destroyers come alongside and we oiled them. We gave them ammunition if they needed it, and generally can pick up oil in the Persian Gulf and give it either to Portsmouth or, in this case, to New Zealand and Australia.
So what capacity...
Pardon?
What oil capacity did the boat have?
Oh, we were about 12,000 tonnes, and that's fuel oil, of course. Sometimes we would carry fuel oil and aviation spirit, say for an aircraft carrier or something. It was quite interesting, and we used to do oiling at sea, and that was more interesting. And that's why we were slightly more trained than the normal merchant service, who didn't have to do those sort of things.
Where did you get your training? At sea, or did you have to go to a college?
No, at sea.
Did you have a good captain?
Pardon?
Did you have a good captain and crew?
Yes. Well, all the officers were employed by the Admiralty, but the crew were just normal seamen who signed on as ordinary merchant service seamen. But, of course, they were all pretty good. They didn't come back if they weren't. However, we sailed from Australia, and we were on our way to Aberdeen to load some more oil, when we were diverted into Colombo, to have the two guns that we carried down in the hold shipped on the deck, one aft and one amidships anti-aircraft. And we were actually at anchor in Colombo Harbour when we listened at 11 o'clock in the morning to Neville Chamberlain, I think his name was, and declare we were now at war with Germany.
What were your feelings about that?
It was inevitable. We all knew it was going to happen. We had practiced blackouts, and we'd practiced everything, really. The Navy took us out to sea, and we fired the gun, both guns. And because I was the only R&R officer on board, although I'd never seen a gun before, I became the gunnery officer. On the way home, we were quite certain we would be sunk in the English Channel, and I just hoped that when we fired the gun, it didn't do more damage to the convoy we escorted than ourselves. Of course, in the event, it was the Tony War period, and we didn't see a single thing.
What sort of ships were you convoying back?
Oh, merchant ships. We loaded in the Persian Gulf, and then we went to port side and we waited there until a convoy of about 50 merchant ships had assembled. And then we were made the Commodore ship, and escorted by three or four or five, maybe, destroyers, we took them home. We diverted off to Portsmouth. Somebody else took over as Commodore, a P&O liner, I think, and they went on to London. But we didn't have any armed conflicts. So although the destroyers dropped a depth charge or two, whether we were sure it was to deter the enemy or they were actually attacking a submarine, we never knew. However, as soon as I arrived in Portsmouth, I signed off the ship, because I had my sufficient time to go and get my foreign going master's certificate. And I went to the Nautical College, Sir John Cass. I'd only been there a fortnight before I was called up to join the Royal Navy. So I eventually got my foreign going master's ticket 7 years later. However, the first appointment in the Royal Navy was to do the gunnery course in Devonport, HMS Drake. And while there, they asked for volunteers for submarines, especially navigators. Well, I was a trained navigator. And although I'd never seen a submarine, I thought it would be quite fun to try and navigate when underwater as well as on the surface. So I volunteered, and the commander, when I volunteered, looked at me as I was a bit wet and assigned them. And of course then, having qualified for the gunnery, more or less, I was sent to Dolphin, where we did the submarine training. We did that for 3 months, and out of the 16 of us, there was 12 RN and 6 RNRs, and 15 of us passed. It was quite an exhausting. We went to sea in the submarine every day.
Did you find it claustrophobic at first? Or?
The very first day, I think we were a little bit apprehensive, but because we were under observation and training, you are so worried about not making a fool of yourself that we forgot about the rest of it completely and utterly. Anyway, I passed quite high up, actually. Second I was, 98%. There were two of us, two R&Rs. We really studied very hard because we were going into an entirely different environment. The young officers who had just come from Dartmouth took it all rather casually and played snooker and fooled around, where we studied like hell. So he and I passed the top of the class by a long way. And but you then were allowed, perhaps I'm being too much, am I telling you too much?
No, it's all the details, the interesting
thing. We were allowed which appointment we would like to go to. There were six wanted to go to Blyth, where it was the biggest flotilla going to Norway and that, and some were out to Malta and so on, and I chose to go to Blyth. And just as we were having the last gin in the boardroom, before we went for our train, the commander came and said, "Look, Ket, you're not going to Blyth after all. The captain of captain of Oberon has asked for you to be his navigator, and so you've got to join her alongside." Well, I was furious to get her to an old, teased out 26-year-old submarine when I thought I was going to go to an operational one. And then in Oberon, we used to sail from Gosport to dive off the Isle of Wight and train destroyers and corvettes and anti-submarine work. And then on one occasion, which I think may be interesting for you, which I haven't read about anywhere, we were dived off Portland with two destroyers, and they dropped a charge over the side, which meant surface, and they said you were to proceed at utmost dispatch to Portsmouth. We thought we were going back to Portland that evening, but we went to Portsmouth, and the invasion of Britain was imminent, 1940. I gather the Germans had got an invasion fleet in Boulogne, and Oberon, 26 years old, leaking oil. We loaded torpedoes to run on the surface, and there were two Dutch boats, O-10 and another O-1, I think, I'm not sure of her, and P-32 and P-49, all pre-war, First War certainly. And we went and we patrolled between Dover and Boulogne, and if the invasion had come, we were to fire our torpedoes to run on the surface and scatter it. In actual fact, we got so close to Boulogne we could see the invasion barges, but then it was, the whole thing was called off and the RAF went and bombed them. And we were returned to Portsmouth, where Admiral Dark met us, and he said, "When I sent you six off, I never expect to see any of you again."
What size submarine was Oberon?
Oberon was... I'm not really sure. In tonnage way, I think she was... her length was 265 feet.
What size crew would you have on that?
In Oberon, we had about 30, maybe 50.
And what sort of sleeping and eating arrangements did you have, and watches?
Well, there were a captain and three officers, and the officers kept four on and four off the whole time. We only had a small wardroom, about as large as this, and we had four bunks. One was reserved for the captain, and the other three were what we called the hot bunk system. So when you came off watch, you turned into the empty bunk and so on. But as I say, she was a training boat, and although we went to sea every morning, we came back in the evening, so it wasn't too arduous really. It was very, very good training from a young submariner point of view, especially as a navigator. I used to take her down on my own from Gosport to the diving area and then call the captain, so that was quite good. But after that so-called nearly invasion, South coast of England was too dangerous, and so we were sent up to Scotland. And to cut the long story short, I was up there for about 3 months at Rothsay, when I was transferred to Dundee to be navigator of Clyde. Now, Clyde was the largest submarine in the world, apart from Surcouf, the French submarine, and when Surcouf had been sunk, and we became the largest. She was 345 feet long. She had a very fast speed, 22.5 knots. Although she was past her prime, really, she was quite a good submarine.
How old was she then?
I think she had been built in 1926? I think so. After, really this is rubbish, but after the Jutland fiasco in the First World War, they realised if only we had had some fast submarines with a fleet, we could have done a lot of damage. So the three river class boats, Thames, Severn and Clyde, were built to do 22.5 knots. But by the time, I think in 1926 now, by the time they were built, the fleet was doing 30 knots, so they really never reached their potential or their design. We cruised off, we did one trip from Dundee while I was in her, off Norway, and she put a torpedo in the Neisenhower, didn't sink her. And then we did another, in the Atlantic, we did a very strange thing. We had a direction finder, and we could dive and put this direction finder up and listen all round, and the idea was to listen for an SOS from a British ship that had been sunk. And the idea, because of our speed, that we would surface, dash off towards it, and hopefully find the German submarine on the surface trying to interrogate the survivors, or we could lend a hand to the survivors. In actual fact, it was November 1940, and the weather was so appalling that we never managed to get to any ship. Empress of Britain was sunk 2 or 3 miles away, well, maybe a bit further, but we didn't get there in time. And we got really, after 26 days on patrol, which was really a long, long while to be in a submarine, we were quite badly damaged, and so we were sent back to Devonport, where we had a refit.
when you came across the Empress?
Pardon?
When you came across the Empress that had been sunk, did you find a...
No, well, we didn't, you see. We listened and we heard the SOS come out that she was being attacked. And then we were told, I don't know quite how, I was only the navigator, that she had been sunk. And we rushed off, but we didn't get there in time. The weather was appalling. We couldn't go more than about 10 knots, and the seas used to come right over the top, and we had a belt and we hooked onto the bridge so we didn't get washed over the side. And when we saw the sea coming, we had to close the hatch, and then the engines slowed down because there wasn't any air, and so on. And by charging backwards and forwards, we never got any succeeded in doing anything except damaging our ship so badly that we couldn't go on doing it. It was an idea. I mean, the idea was all right, but really, we couldn't have helped very much. But there was a time, you know, when the Germans sank a ship, they used to surface and take the captain or chief engineer prisoner and interrogate them, where have you come from, that sort of thing. And that's what we were really trying to prevent. Saving life wasn't really our job. Anyway, it didn't work, and so we went back to the Clyde and to Devonport and refitted.
So while
I remained in her, and by that time I had become her first lieutenant.
So when you were in Devonport, you had some chance to have some time off?
And no, I was kept on the ship, you see. Mm. I did 2 years in Clyde, which is pretty unusual.
Yes.
But I was promoted to first lieutenant.
Were your parents anxious about you being in a submarine?
I didn't tell them I was in submarines. But my sister found out. I suppose they were anxious, I don't know. We didn't have a lot of leave, you know, during the war. And when Clyde had finished its refitting, we went out to the Mediterranean, and we were based in Gib. And there, as I've told you, we patrolled off Toulon, German naval base. And we also patrolled it in Beirut, I think, and Iran. And then when Malta was besieged and the convoys had tried to get through, HMS Eagle had been sunk in one convoy, and Malta was really besieged, the Admiralty decided to try and make it possible to take cargo, aviation spirit ammunition to Malta by submarine. Now, it suited me very well because I'd been used to tanker life, so and after that, in the submarine service, I was always called tanker. I think they really called me tankard, but it was Captain S or Admiral Submarines that said he called me tanker, but they christened it to tankard. Anyway, we did 5 voyages to Malta in Clyde.
So how much fuel were you able to take then?
Well, we took about 1,500 tons of aviation spirit, and we'd taken the battery out of... We had 3 batteries, and they were... each battery section weighed 46 tons. So we got rid of one battery, which we really needed when we long dived, but that gave us a nice clear hold, about 14 by 8 by about... 6, and that was like a cargo hold in which we could load ammunition, because when we filled the ballast tanks, not with seawater but with aviation spirit, we were lighter and we couldn't dive, so we needed weight to dive, and we did that by taking 8-inch shells, anti-aircraft shells, to the gunners of Malta. We also took powdered milk and ham, tinned ham, and the food that was urgently needed in Malta. On one occasion, the army were loading us, and they asked me to take a case of lipsticks. And I said, no way I'm going to take lipsticks to Malta. I would rather take another box of milk. But they said, well, it's good for morale, and the captain agrees, and he had the case of lipsticks in his cabin, and I wouldn't have them in my cargo hold. However, the first trip we got to Malta, and we were alongside discharging, the captain had gone ashore. I had a signal to say German reconnaissance has been over and you've probably been identified. Shut down immediately and dive and sit on the bottom in the Grand Harbour. So I did this, and while we were down we were heavily bombed or depth charged, and although all the lights went out, we didn't know we'd sustained any real damage. But when we surfaced after dark, we found that the after hydroplanes had been shattered. And this made it terribly difficult to dive. When we tried to dive, having discharged our cargo, we were completely out of control, and we went up and down, blowing main ballast and using up lots of energy. And eventually, and on about the second occasion, it was about 4 o'clock in the morning, we were machine-gunned by German aircraft. You could hear the shrapnel on the casing. So the captain said, take her down number one and put her on the bottom. Well, I really did think, and so did the coxswain, that we were going down for the last time. But fortunately, we touched the bottom nice and gently at 190 feet, and we stayed on the bottom until dark. And then we surfaced and came back in. And that's when we found that the after hydroplanes weren't working.
Were you able to mend those?
Well, what we did was to lash them with wire over the top of the hull so that they remained amidships. And then when we eventually sailed, if we went very, very slowly, we could control her just on the four planes alone and pumping water from fore and aft. And we came back to Gib quite safely. It took 11 days. It was quite a long passage. But so after that, the next four trips we did to Malta, we weren't allowed to go into the main harbour. It was too dangerous. And we then went to Marsa Salop, which is on the southeast of the island. I used to take the submarine to sea during the day and sit on the bottom. And then we came alongside in the dark, alongside the petrol pier to discharge. I don't know if it would amuse you, or I don't know if you can delete any of this. I brought this, captain used to go ashore and I took her to sea. And when I came alongside, there were quite dark on the petrol pier, no shelter, nothing. There were two chaps on the quay and they shouted up to me, is your captain on board? And I said, no. And they said, when will he come? And I said, well, he normally comes on the back of Captain S's motorcycle, about an hour's time. I said, please come on board if you want to see him. And they said, no, we'd rather stay here, in rather a blousy voice. But I said, well, it's up to you. Well, then we started discharging, and gradually an air raid began. So I had to shut the boat down, shift the petrol lighter along the quay, and close down, you see. And then we were sitting in the wardroom, and I could hear the shrapnel on the casing. And I thought, my God, those poor chaps on the jetty. So I went up on the bridge, and I shouted down, don't be fooled, come on board. It's much safer. And they said, you said your captain would be here. So I said, well, he probably won't come till the air raid's over. Come on board, it's much safer than standing on the quay. No, we'll stay here. I said, all right, it's up to you. And I went down again, and then it really got quite bad, and I thought it's madness for those men to stay on the quay. So I went down, I climbed down, walked along the jetty to them, all in the dark, and I said, look, don't be such bloody fools, come on board, it's much safer. And then there was an almighty explosion, and to my horror, I saw that the naval officer had two scrambled eggs round his and gold braid all over him, and I realised he was an admiral. And the soldier had bands down here with red, and I realised he was. So I said, I meant, don't be bloody fool, sir. And the admiral smiled, and he said, don't worry about that. I think we would like to come on board if we may. And I took them on board and gave them a gin or something. And then the air raid stopped, and I finished the cargo, and the captain came down. And at 4 o'clock, and the admiral turned out to be Admiral Latham, who had just become governor of Malta. And then when the captain came aboard with Captain S, they sat in the boardroom and talked to one another while I finished his job. And at 4 o'clock in the morning, we finished and battened down. We were ready for sea. I went along to the boardroom. I said, excuse me, sir, but we are ready for sea. And the admiral said, could I give this young man a drink? So the captain said, sit down, number one, what would you like? So I said, well, you seem to be having whiskey. A small whiskey would be fine. And I always end up by saying, it's not many people that call the admiral, the governor of Malta, a bloody fool, and get a whiskey. Anyway, we, in order to, having discharged our 1,500 tons of cargo, we were really too light to dive again. And so to make up for that, we took some ballast, but we also took survivors, men from Navy and merchant ships, American and British, who had survived from their ships being torpedoed. And they signed a document to say they would accept the conditions that we would had. And we took about 57 and we took them back to Jib. But the conditions they were under were pretty primitive. They weren't allowed to go to the toilets in the day, in the daytime. And they were told they had to lie down and not walk around because we didn't want to use up too much oxygen. But they were all glad when we arrived in Jib to be taken back to civilization.
They must have found it pretty claustrophobic as well. They must have found it pretty claustrophobic if they've not been used to a submarine.
They were down in the battery tank, which was now empty, and there were about 30 men down there. You can imagine the conditions are pretty awful. But on the other hand, had they not been able to come out in the submarine, they would have been stuck in Malta. While we were in Clyde, I've really gone ahead a bit, but you know about Enigma.
Yes.
Well, one day, Clyde was, we were painted snowy white because we were sent down to Freetown to work with destroyers down Freetown way. And but on the way down, we were suddenly diverted to go at utmost dispatch to Tarrafal Bay in the Cape Verde Islands, where it is believed German submarines are refueling one another. So we dashed on the surface all the way, and we got to the Tarrafal Bay about 10 o'clock at night, and we went in on the surface. It was a very calm night, which was unfortunate for us, and we went into the bay, and immediately we saw a German submarine crossing the bow, and the captain fired 6 torpedoes at it, and I turned to the lookouts and said, now don't take watch what the captain's doing, keep a damn good lookout because we know there may be other boats. And as I came round to the port side, there was another German submarine just half a ship's length away, and he dived and he went underneath us, and I looked over, the captain looked over this side and saw the bow, and I looked over my side and saw the propellers. The men down below said they'd heard a bump, but on the bridge we didn't hear that. The torpedoes we had fired missed. The submarine had turned round, and apparently, all in the dark, you don't really know what's happening. And so we dived and reloaded our torpedoes, and then we came up again, and Captain and I went on the bridge. I was then first navigator still, and then they said there's another signal come from Admiralty, so he said, you take over, I'll go down and read it. And immediately there was a little submarine on the starboard bow, so close there was nothing you could do other than try and ram it. So I ordered hard the starboard, full head together, and captain on the bridge, of course, shut watertight doors, and we started to turn towards her. The captain came rushing back up again and took over, but we just missed her bow by a few feet, and she hit our stern. She went right up in the air and terrific flash. And then we dived. And the men in the after compartment of Clyde, where the steering gear and the hydroplanes were, having heard the bang and seen water coming in, left their compartment and shut the watertight door. But our engineer officer, Lieutenant Gay, said, open the door again and let's see what the damage is. So it was very clever of him, and he found it was not very great, and by caulking they could quickly cure up the leak, and so we were able to continue the patrol. It's interesting, I told you we'd been painted white. Now the German, which was unfortunate, to go into a dark bay painted white while the Germans are painted black gave them a terrific advantage. And later, years later, when I became a pilot and I took a ship to Hamburg, I was relieved by the German pilot. And as we sat together, having a gin or something, he said to me, we sank HMS 7. So I said, well, I know HMS 7 once wasn't sunk. Tell me more. And he said, well, he knocked her stern off. So I said, well, the ship you hit was actually Clyde and I was the navigator. He said, I was navigator too. Why didn't you fire your gun at us? And I said, we didn't have time. Why didn't you fire your gun at us? And he said, we didn't have time either. But he said, you showed up snap.